Elizabeth Barrett is a wife, mother, grandmother, licensed marriage and family therapist, educator, eavesdropper, and emotion worker. She uses all of these skills to address the subjects we all struggle with in this conversation with a reluctant therapist. Happy Tuesday, Elizabeth. What's happening today?
Happy Tuesday, Hank. What's on my mind today is that we're going to have a conversation that's probably more uncomfortable than people are ready for, because it's a conversation that most of us don't really ever want to have. We're going to talk about suicide because it's Suicide Prevention Awareness Month, and because it's in not talking about something like suicide that makes suicide all the more scary and overwhelming and dangerous. You know, it's in not talking about something because we're uncomfortable that we put ourselves at a higher risk of experiencing or being around someone who is feeling suicidal and not knowing what to do. So that's what's on my mind today.
Okay.
I usually
respond with some sort of quip at this point, but not today.
No, I don't think there's an easy banter that goes with this topic. But I think every year we do a show in September around suicide, and every year I think about, you know, can I do this show again? Are people willing to stick with us for an hour? Is it something that we're okay talking about? It's difficult to go there. My family has had intimate experiences with suicide, so it triggers a lot of emotions and feelings within me and my family, who I know all listen every week. And so I understand that if I'm feeling this way, that it must also trigger and bring up uncomfortable feelings for my listeners. But I hope that people stick with it. I hope that you'll stay for this hour and be a part of the conversation, or at least listen in on the conversation and sit with your discomfort long enough to come up with maybe a little more a sense of understanding or of peace, or maybe you won't feel more understanding or be at peace or be calm, but at least you'll have more information. And you'll also understand that you're not alone. Before I did this show today, I did call my dad on the way into the station because my uncle, his brother, committed suicide when I was in college. So this is quite a long time ago, but it was one of the most shocking things that happened in my life, and I know it was a life-changing moment in time for my father and for the rest of his family and for his brothers, and to carry even 30-something years later that sense of, could I have done something? Should I have known something was wrong? Were there warning signs that I needed to catch? And that guilt and that pain really is difficult to live with for years and years and years. And so I did call my dad to give him a heads up and say, hey, Dad, I give you a pass if you don't want to listen today, because he always listens in. But it's important because it got the conversation rolling for us again. 30-something years later, we were talking about how much my uncle had struggled his entire life with depression and mental health issues, but also not quite fitting in, not really knowing his place in the world, always, you know, trying to find a new normal or a new way of living and never really getting there. And so... Still 30-something years later, my dad is freshly talking about that day and that last phone call and my other uncle finding him. And it's fresh and it's there, and it's important to keep talking about, to be able to voice those feelings of grief even 30-something years later. So I know it's something that we don't want to talk about because it's terrifying. It's something that we don't want to imagine. It's also overwhelming to feel like we could ever feel so hopeless or desperate or angry or crazed that we might consider taking our own life, to think that those feelings might live inside of us. We don't like to hear about suicide or talk about people who are suicidal or feel suicidal because we're afraid we'll catch it. That's terrifying. It's terrifying because so many of us have actually thought about suicide, either in passing or in a more serious way. And we might have entertained the thought of thinking about suicide, and the fear is that if I think about it, it'll take roots inside of my psyche and I won't be able to shake it. And I could never admit to someone else, even to myself, that I've allowed suicide to come into my consciousness. We might fear that if we acknowledge the thought, that it will grow inside of us, that it won't be passing, that it'll become a viable option, that if we bring it up to someone else and they're feeling suicidal, that our mere suggestion that they're feeling suicidal will tip them over the edge. We fear saying the wrong thing. We fear feeling the wrong things. We tend to shy away from suicide, not calmly, but aggressively. People don't want to have the conversation. I don't want to talk about it. It's too depressing. It's too depressing. It's too overwhelming. But our silence about suicide then creates a sense of shame and stigma around suicide and the survivors of suicide, the people that are left behind when someone in their family or their group commits suicide. It leaves them without an outlet, without an ability to talk about what they've experienced or how this has impacted their lives, because we want suicide to be invisible. We don't want it to be something that's talked about easily, because we don't want it to become an option or something that's viable. And so the darkness of suicidal ideation in those who are feeling it becomes even deeper. It becomes more isolating and lonely, because people fear talking out loud about these feelings that they're having, because they're afraid they'll be alienated or stigmatized or medicated or shunned because they're having these feelings. And the families that have experienced suicide are afraid to talk about it because they don't want to be shunned, or maybe people will think that they didn't do enough, that they somehow weren't there when the people in their lives needed them. And there's also this part of us that wants to write suicide off as merely a mental health issue. Well, all people who attempt suicide or are suicidal have mental illness, and that's why. So as long as I don't have mental illness, I'll be fine. But that's a false sense of security, because suicide does not only impact those with mental illness. We might go into a period of mental illness. If you're considering suicide, you can understand that. But it's not the fact of having mental illness that drives someone to suicide. There are many, many people who live with mental illness their entire life and are not suicidal. And there are many, many people who would not be considered mentally ill who commit suicide. And so it's important to separate those things out. And when we fail to talk about suicide, we start to believe that we are the only ones who are feeling this way. If we think that our suicidal ideation or our thoughts of suicide or experience in suicide makes us seem broken, makes us seem untouchable, unlovable, unapproachable, it exacerbates those feelings that we're having and continues to drive the suicidal ideation. And so I often wonder, what would it be like if we actually stopped down and looked around in crowded places that we are and realized that millions of people are having the same thoughts that we're having, the same experiences of isolation or fear or concern. Many people are having the same suicidal ideations every day. And instead of having it be something that happens in the dark, away, isolated, hidden from public view, but it became part of the conversation in our public discourse, how would that change our understanding of suicide? How would that impact the lives of people who are considering attempting suicide? Would lives be saved? And would we maybe change how we see and view suicide as a whole? So this is a conversation with a reluctant therapist. I'm Elizabeth Barrett. And if this conversation is already triggering feelings of distress in you, I want you to know that there is the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline that's available 24/7. And that number is 800-273-TALK, 800-273-8255. And if you'd rather text, you can text to 741-741 and say, "I need help," and someone will get to you right away. And if you're able to stay with the conversation today, which I hope you will, I hope you'll consider calling in and sharing your experiences or your thoughts about this issue. And our number is 805-781-3875. And we will have phone numbers for support lines, support phone numbers for you if you call into the station or you call into 781-3875. Dan has those numbers for you at any time during the show if you'd like to follow up with that. But before I go any further, I'd like to introduce my guest who is here with me in the studio today. Christine Claxton has been very patiently sitting beside me, and I appreciate you nodding as I was going through some of the information. It makes me feel like I'm not alone.
Yes, thank you, Elizabeth. You're right on.
In the thoughts that I'm having. Mm-hmm. Christine is a volunteer with the American Foundation for Suicide Prevention, and this year she is the chair for this year's Out of the Darkness Walk in San Luis Obispo, which will be taking place October 14th in Mission Plaza. And so, Christine, welcome to the show, and thank you for coming in.
Thank you for having me. This is an important topic, so I really appreciate you taking the time.
And just to start off, let's talk about a few of the stats that makes this such an important conversation. Mm-hmm. People might not know that suicide is at its highest rate right now as it's been in 30 years. That there was a period of time in the 80s and 90s that suicide had actually leveled off, and then it has consistently continued to grow over the last decade.
Yes, and American Foundation for Suicide Prevention has a goal of reducing suicide by 20% by 2025. When we established that goal, it was at that low rate, and unfortunately through these years, it has gone higher and risen. And so it's just making our job more important, and we're more committed to reducing it as best we can.
And I think when we look at the increased rates of suicide, it's important to understand that it crosses all of the age, right? All of the lifespan. There is not a particular age that suicide is most likely to happen. That we see it in adolescence, we see it in people in midlife and the elderly.
That's it. It does. It's not specific to any age group, gender, or anything. It crosses all barriers.
A couple other statistics. It's the fourth leading cause of death for those who are 5 to 14. That statistic frightens me on a fundamental level, that they even include someone as young as 5 years old. But I know there have been instances of bullying where young children 9, 10 years old have taken their own lives. So it's the fourth leading cause of death for that age group. The third leading cause of death for those 15 to 24. There are 4 male suicides for every female suicide, but females make 3 times the suicide attempts that men do. It's estimated that there are 8 to 25 attempts of suicide for every suicidal death. And so it's something that touches every single family. As I mentioned at the start of the show, my uncle committed suicide many years ago, and then a year ago, my cousin committed suicide. We were the same age. We grew up together. We played sports together. And then we went off to college at the same time, and she developed an incredibly challenging eating disorder and depression that just really took hold of her life. All through our entire adult lives, she struggled. And there was help that was provided and people trying to step in. But, you know, when she finally took her life last year, there was part of me that kind of got it. In a horrible way, I kind of got it, that she had been battling her life, basically, since she was in college.
That is part of the grief process in suicide that's different than other grief processes, is that sometimes there is that point of relief for that person, that they are no longer struggling with that, and they're now at peace and all of that. And it's a different piece. But then when you feel that relief, it's then the guilt also comes in of, but that's not right. I shouldn't be relieved that they're gone. I miss them. So it's a balance, and it's hard, and it's a struggle, and it's truly a lifelong struggle once you lose that person. It never changes.
Because you never really get the answers that you hope for. So there's never any completion of the relationship or...
No. It's never put to rest. It's always that question.
My guest is Christine Claxton. I'm Elizabeth Barrett. This is A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist. And Paul, what's on your mind today?
Oh, I was, since you sound like you've, done your homework. It was, suicide was common in the Greco-Roman world, Brutus and Cassius, and in shame cultures. And then, of course, the Bushido Code, it was a tenet of that. We're not saying as Westerners or as modern cultures that it doesn't have its place. I just listened to your comment about your cousin. I'm certainly not making light of it, there has to be room in our modern Western culture for suicide to be an answer at times.
Paul, and I appreciate you bringing that up because it does kind of fall in line with what I was mentioning to Christine, that I have really conflicting feelings about suicide because of my experience watching my cousin struggle all of her life. I think of the life of David Foster Wallace, who is an author who I had the honor of meeting a couple times in his life, and he struggled with mental health issues from the time he was a teen, and he was on medications and off medications and wrote these, you know, life-changing novels, but he in the end committed suicide in his 50s because he could no longer struggle, and I understand that. And so I feel like I have this split experience with suicide. Then we talk about adolescent suicide, those under the age of 25, I have no gray area. They haven't lived long enough or have the developmental bandwidth to understand the choice they're making to end their life, that when an adolescent makes a choice in their life, it's more often an impulsive act that's made within a few hours and not over a lifetime. And so I have no gray areas that we should be intervening as aggressively as possible with those, you know, under the age of 25. But then when we see someone in their late stage of life, the elderly or in midlife or with chronic illness, then I do understand and I feel like there needs to be a place for the conversation of suicide. So thank you for bringing that up, Paul. And I think that's the most challenging part of the conversation is that dichotomy.
I agree. I don't have an answer to that. Like you say, it is a whole different ball of wax between a young child or a young person contemplating suicide and someone who has lived their whole life, struggled, and just gets to that point where you think, I can't take another day of it. And I'm with you. I can see where they're coming from, and I don't know if saving them for what? What are we going to protect them from? So I don't know.
And then as a psychotherapist, I think, but there should always be something we can try, right? There should always be some intervention or something maybe we missed that might turn the corner for them. And so, as I said, I'm deeply, deeply conflicted with my feelings about the topic. So Christine is the chair of the Out of the Darkness Walk in San Luis Obispo. Can you talk a bit about what inspired the walk, how long it's been around, and who participates and why?
So the American Foundation for Suicide Prevention has been around for 30 years. The walks that we have around the country, we have chapters in every state and multiple in California because we're such a large state, that the walks are the main fundraising way that the foundation raises money for all its different areas of study. So that's why the walks were developed, to raise money. The side point to the walk is that it's a time where people can get together and healing takes place. So you've got people who have lost loved ones, lost survivors, as you mentioned, will be there. And that grief is so different than other griefs that once you meet someone who has lost a family member to suicide, there's that bond, that connection that you know what I've gone through, you know what I've been through, and you know what I'm going through. So that bond is so tight. But you also have people who have attempted suicide and have come on the other side with that hope, and you can make it through it. So those people are also there at the walk. So the walk is just a great time of joy, of sadness, of laughter, all of the above. So it's just a neat time of healing and gathering for people.
It's actually a reflection of life itself.
Yes.
That there is never just all good or all bad, that we experience all the feelings of joy and grief simultaneously.
Yes, definitely. Definitely. And then at the walk itself, we'll also have resource tables. We have a large group of resource tables from everybody in the community. So there's just so much information out there and so many groups that need to be connected together that this is a perfect opportunity in this community. The walk here is only 5 years old, so it's really, I'm going to say, brand new. It's a baby for sure. But it's growing in its numbers every year. So this year we're already at one of our highest numbers yet.
Of
registered walkers.
And can people still register to walk?
Absolutely. You can register to walk, and you can go to afsp.org/SLO to register, and you can register up to Friday before the walk. The walk is October 14th. And then if you would still like to walk, you can register day of.
Oh, so you can just show up. And what is the time of the event on the 14th?
It's at 8:45. We start registering people, and then the walk will start at 10, and the whole event will be done by noon.
And as you said, there are walks going on all over the country. I went to the website and saw the list.
Yeah.
And do you know if there are walks in Monterey and Santa Barbara County as well?
Santa Barbara just had theirs last Saturday. Monterey County, I'm not sure about when it is, but I know they are having one.
So AFSP.org will give you information about that.
Yes. Yes.
And so, Christine, what brought you to this organization? What brought you to volunteer for the American Foundation for Suicide Prevention and to be the chair of this event?
I am a lost survivor. My son, who was 20 years old, 5 years ago, struggled with mental illness and ended his life by suicide. And it's taken me 5 years to get to this point to be able to work with the American Foundation for Suicide Prevention. And it's actually brought about healing and actually given me the courage to talk about suicide. Prior, I've only been working with them for about a year. And prior to that, suicide in our family, we didn't talk about it. We just kind of shoved it under the table. And I didn't want Zachary's, my son, his memory to be that it was just he died and that's it. We don't get to talk about him anymore. So now he's talked about every day, and suicide is talked about every day in our household, and it's just becoming part of the daily conversation. And that's what I want for people. It needs to be part of the conversation. People should still ask me, so I know you lost your son Zachary, how are you feeling about that today? It's okay to ask those questions. That's what I'm hoping will happen with these walks and events and stuff like that, open the conversation.
So how was it for you, though, because you didn't have a background in suicide prevention or any experience with suicide and probably never wanted to have any information about suicide, what was it like for you initially when Zachary killed himself, and how did you even cope with that?
It was devastating. I knew he was struggling, and I knew he had suicidal ideation, but the fact that he was actually going to complete it, I didn't think was going to happen. So when it happened, it was shocking for sure. It was shocking to his brothers and sisters. And it pretty much called it, you know, that line in the sand of where your life changes, that's where it changed. I luckily had a huge support system around me through church and through work that just totally lifted me up and supported me. Hospice here in San Luis Obispo has a great grief program, and I was there for over a year trying to work through the grief and figure out how do you do life again? Mm-hmm. Because my normal changed completely, and now, even to this day, it's a whole new normal that I deal with on a daily basis because of his death.
Did you ever imagine that you would be out speaking about this and chairing an organization?
Never in a million years. And that's, I was talking to my son who lives in Florida, and he just kind of laughed at me. He goes, Mom, I can't believe you're going to do that. But I don't want Zachary's life to end there. I want his story to continue. So this is his story that's continuing through the work that I do with the foundation.
Absolutely. And do you have other children though? You say you have a son in Florida. How did Zachary's death impact them? And were you concerned about, you know, a contagion, which is something that people talk about, that suicide happens oftentimes over and over in family systems?
It does. It really is familial, unfortunately. And I did worry about it, and I do worry about it. And there's not a lot I can do other than check in with my family and with the kids. So my son in Florida, he's in the Air Force. So we talk about it a little bit at a time. It's hard to talk about, and I'm not sure where he is, but he knows that he can talk to me anytime. And then he has another brother who Zachary was very instrumental. I have two adopted children, so he was very instrumental in bringing them home. So my other son, who is Wen Ku, he is 20 now, but he was very close to Zachary. So telling him that Zachary died was pretty hard on him. And I'm not really sure how he processed it all. But he seems to be doing well, and he writes notes that I'll find, I miss you, Zachary, and sweet little things like that. So he's dealing with it as well. And then he has his sister, who is 16 now, and she was very reserved when he died and didn't really want to talk about Zachary and didn't want to talk about his death. It was pretty much ignored. Mm-hmm. And then in this past 2 years since I've started working with the American Foundation. She's my right-hand man. She's talking about it. She's posting information about the walk at the high schools. She comes to the meetings, the volunteer meetings, and she's vocal. She's very active, and it's just so nice to see her blossom past that grief of hers and starting to deal and work it through.
Well, and imagine as a mother with children that are still home and needing you, that forced you to be active in your grieving and opening and moving forward. There was not really an opportunity for you to shut down.
No, there wasn't. And that was one of the biggest things that I worked with my counselor, is that I have children that I still have to take care of, and I don't know how to do that. I don't know how I'm going to get the laundry done or the grocery shopping done, things like that. Luckily, that's where my friends and family and support group stepped in, and they did a lot of my grocery shopping for me for months. But I did. I had to go to school. I had to be participatory in their lives and supportive of them. And it was hard. It was really, really hard. But somehow it worked.
Well, and also it's different losing a family member to suicide than losing a family member to cancer, because there is that shame and stigma attached to it. So fortunately, you had a support system that rushed in to support you. But for a lot of people, you know, when it's suicide, it becomes isolating and alienating because people don't want to catch it, whatever it was that caused your son to kill himself. So they back away.
Definitely. And they do back away. And so after that, it's funny because after that support, they do back away. And now they're afraid to bring up Zachary. How is he? Or, you know, how is it going for you? They don't mention him. Mm-hmm. When they ask you how are your children, they kind of brush over him. So they don't know how to react to it. Whereas I believe that if he had died from a cancer, he would have been part of the conversation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it becomes ongoing. And so that therein lies where we still have so much work to do when it comes to working with suicide or suicide prevention and awareness and understanding how we live with the fact of suicide in our culture. You know, it is a fact of our society that suicide exists, that suicide ideation is real, that people choose to take their life, that adolescents more than ever today are seeing suicide as a potential outlet or potential choice that they have. And that's, I think, why the work might feel a little daunting.
It is. And it's hard to see that is a choice that people even consider, but I can also see how they get there. So that's why it's so important that we talk about the resources available to people. There are so many, and it just takes a phone call. It takes a text. It takes even an email to somebody just to have that conversation. And it also goes back to you and I, you know, your friends, your people, checking in. How are you feeling? Are you having suicidal thoughts? I mean, have that conversation. And don't be afraid to say suicide. That's what it comes down to. It's just a word.
Right. No hush hush.
Yeah.
This is A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist. I'm Elizabeth Barrett. If you're just tuning in, my guest today is Christine Claxton. She's a volunteer with the American Foundation for Suicide Prevention, and she's the chair for this year's Out of the Darkness Walk in San Luis Obispo. And we're talking about suicide. And I think it's important to talk about some of the reasons. People want to know, why does this happen? Because I think that's what makes the conversation so difficult. People don't understand, how could anyone get to this point? So when it comes to teens, here are some of the reasons that teens contemplate or attempt suicide. Usually they have a traumatic experience that they're not emotionally or developmentally equipped to deal with, whether it's losing a parent or a difficult breakup or not getting into a coveted college or a competition of some sort, or a sexual assault, sexual abuse of some time, physical abuse. One of these stressful events can trigger an already lingering predisposition to feeling inadequate or depressed or persecuted or misunderstood. Now, we have to understand that being an adolescence itself is challenging under the best circumstances. The whole developmental stage of adolescence is about little deaths, the leaving behind of your childhood and moving into adulthood in that kind of strange liminal space of who am I between child and adult. And so when adolescents have another stressful event on top of the fact that they're adolescents, they can start to feel trapped or hopeless. It becomes overwhelming to bear the pain. everything is magnified. Everything feels like the worst thing that they'll ever experience. Because think about it, if you're 15 and you've had your first love affair, it is the worst thing that's ever happened in your life when it ends, because you don't have 30 or 40 years of context of all the wonderful things that can happen. For an adolescent, quite often the decision to commit suicide does not include any sort of developmental understanding of the magnitude and permanence of suicide itself, that they're thinking only of ending the immediate pain that they're feeling, and they really can't comprehend that the death is forever. Teens, as we all know, tend to be reluctant to share their thoughts and feelings. They often conceal the pain and fears that they're having because they don't want their parents to worry about them, which as a parent is always the worst thing ever. But I know that our children try to protect us from their dark thoughts, thinking we can't handle it. And Christine and I want to let you all know we can handle it, right?
Yes. Yes.
Every parent can handle it. There's nothing you can tell us that we can't handle. We might blanch. We might catch our breath. But there's nothing our children can tell us that we can't handle. And that's across the board for every parent I've ever known. And I wish teens and their friends knew that. And any of my teens' friends knew that, that there's nothing you could tell me if you can't tell your own parents that you can't, you can tell me anything. And I will help you. You know, it's that whole idea of it takes a village, because maybe you can't go to your parent. It is too overwhelming. But there's some adult out there that you can approach, and that adult will jump in and do what they can. There is an increased social pressure on teens that we are just beginning to scratch the surface about understanding. We don't understand the cyber connections. Teens can be challenging to deal with for adults. And so for a lot of adults, when teens start to get snarky or bad-tempered or ill-tempered, or they say, I don't need you, or I'm not going to talk to you, or they're moody, it is really tempting to back away from an unruly teen. And so I think that is the challenge for adults, is how do we keep moving in when our teens are trying to push us away? How do we get them to talk when they're trying to push us away? The main thing is don't ask too many questions. Teens do not like to be peppered with questions. Make observations. Give them options for a response. Say, hey, it looks like you're not hanging out with your friends as often, or it looks like you're, you know, not spending as much time on the basketball court. Make observations. Don't say, why aren't you playing basketball? Why aren't you hanging out with your friends? Because that immediately sets a teen up on the defensive. Give them many options for different ways to respond. Hey, what are the things you look forward to at school these days? Just observations. Looks like you're sleeping more than usual. Listen fully without waiting to respond. Acknowledge their feelings. Listen, listen, listen. Don't jump in and say, oh, it'll pass, or you'll be fine, or you shouldn't make such a big deal out of it. All those things we want to say as parents because we are a little afraid that our teens might be suicidal. You need to listen all the way and acknowledge what they're feeling and have empathy and understand that when a teen tells you this is the worst thing they've ever experienced in their life, it is the worst thing they've ever experienced because they don't have the life experience to have experienced anything else. So we're going to continue this conversation and talk about the feelings of college students and what drives them towards suicide, and about midlife adults and older adults. And we also want to take your calls. Our number is 805-781-3875. Rick, I know I have you on the line. Please hang with us. We're going to take a short break, gather ourselves, and be back to continue this conversation. I'm Elizabeth Barrett, here with Christine Claxton, and you're listening to Central Coast Public Radio, KCBX.
You gotta swim, swim for your life, swim for the music that saves you when you're not so sure you'll survive. You gotta swim, and swim when it hurts. The whole world is watching. You haven't come this far to fall off the earth. The currents will pull you away from your love. Just keep your head above. I found a tidal wave begging to tear down the dawn.
An important resource for our listeners is the National Suicide Hotline. The phone number is 800-273-8255. We have additional local resources you can find out. Call the KCBX central phone number. That's 805-549-8855, and we'll pass on some additional local resources to you. Again, the National Suicide Hotline, 800-273-8255.
Through wars without cause, swim for the lost politicians who don't see their greed as a flaw. The currents will pull us away from our love.
This is A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist. I'm Elizabeth Barrett. And Rick, thanks for waiting. What's on your mind today?
I wanted to talk just briefly about why people get in such a state that they feel like committing suicide.
Okay.
I think that when people feel caught up in something that they can't control and they can't tolerate it any longer, they get depressed and they want a way out.
Mm-hmm.
I think that the problem with a lot of people, whether they're veterans of war who've done things that give them recurring nightmares, or people who are suffering abuse or whatever, is the feeling that there's no way that they can get out of the situation they're in. And I think, if you're talking about teens and stuff, obviously society has to offer them some alternatives, because when you're in school and under the control of your parents, you really don't have much control or freedom in your life to pick a different path. But when people get older, there should be a feeling of freedom. And unfortunately, our society creates such a stigma on anyone departing from the path towards material success, money, a good job, all that kind of thing, that it's hard to find another way. And I know when I was in my 20s, a lot of people in my generation decided that we didn't like the way society was going, and got together and kind of broke out and found a new way. And what we discovered is that life by itself is worth living. Life is enjoyable if you're free. And I think it's really important to realize that you can be free of whatever you're going through if you just simply let go of all attachments to any kind of outcome and let yourself relax and take in what is good just in being alive.
And I think what you say, thank you, Rick, for sharing that. I think what you said is true, that for teens, for young people who feel like they don't have autonomy from their family, they aren't able to make their own choices, they maybe are making choices to make their parents happy or grandparents happy, that it does make it feel like suicide is the only way out the door. And how it's interesting also, this idea that if we can just embrace life or see that life is worth living, or, get out and take a walk every day and get into nature, like all those things as mental health professionals that we encourage people to do to maintain their mental health. The difficult thing is that when you're in that dark place, when you're in that box, there is no light shining. And so the walls start to close in, which makes it even more challenging to get out, that you almost need a lifeline. You need a person that recognizes that you're struggling, who pulls you out. I think it's very challenging for an individual to pull themselves out of a suicidal state.
Oh, I agree completely that once you're in that hole, to see out is difficult. Even just in my grief from my son, I couldn't see the light of day. The fact of having to get out of bed and do acts of daily living were just overwhelming. So to be in that suicidal state and have that same feeling, it's impossible to crawl out, I would imagine. It would be very difficult. That you do need that hand to someone to reach out and just say, let me help you. How are you feeling? Let's talk about this. Let me hear what's going on in your life.
So let's talk a little bit about some of the things that we can do if we sense that someone's struggling, because it's important to take action, even though our first response usually is, I don't want to make it worse. I don't want to say something that's going to make it worse.
Yeah, that is the fear, I think. And I don't want to suggest, are you feeling suicidal? Because, oh my gosh, I just planted that seed.
Right. What if they weren't thinking about
yeah,
it?
Yeah, but oh, now they are. So we need to get away from that. It's because just by me mentioning suicide is not going to make you feel suicidal. It's either it's already been a thought in your head or it's not a thought in your head. And either way, having the question posed is not going to change it.
So here are a couple phrases to use to start the conversation. You know, just knowing how to broach it might help. You might say, I noticed that you've mentioned feeling hopeless lately. Or I noticed that you've mentioned that life isn't worth living. Or I've noticed that you aren't participating as happily in your activities lately. You fill in whatever that sign is that you recognize has changed in someone you're close to. And it doesn't have to be a family member. There might be someone in your office or someone that you pass every day or someone that you ride on the bus with. You don't know who you're touching every day. If you have a sense inside that someone you're making contact with in the community is showing you signs of distress, then ask that question. I noticed that you've mentioned or are acting differently. And then allow them to go on from there. Allow them to carry on, either say, oh, no, yes, everything's fine, or no, I am struggling. Or you might start off the conversation by saying, sometimes when people feel like they are thinking about suicide, sometimes people feel horribly and they start thinking about suicide. And I'm wondering, are you thinking about suicide? And that might be the most shocking thing to tell someone to say, but that actually can be the one sentence that prevents someone from committing suicide. If you actually said to someone, are you thinking about suicide? You show them that you're not afraid to talk about it, and you might become that safe person.
Absolutely. And it's that you have to think about it, that you may be the one and only person reaching out to them, and that's you're their lifeline. So don't ever not take that opportunity. Take the opportunity to ask those questions.
And if they say no, say, well, just wanted to check in, and why don't we go for a walk?
Exactly.
Or why don't we go, you know, get a soda together, or do something just to continue that connection of life. But if they respond yes to you, first stay calm. And as I was mentioning, Christine, as parents, you get really good at kind of keeping a neutral face when your children tell you something that you're almost not ready to hear. But stay calm. Keep breathing. Your breathing will help them to calm down. And don't leave them alone.
That's it. Don't leave them alone.
Make sure you stay with them until you've obtained help, whether that's calling their parents, calling 911, calling a hotline number, the Suicide Prevention Lifeline number, 800-273-TALK. Stay with them until that help arrives, that backup help that arrives. And don't be dissuaded if the person gets angry at you.
No, because that's part of it, too. And yes, they will get angry, and that's just okay.
Yes. If they say, don't make a big deal of this, or this is my business, or I'm making this choice myself, once they bring you into their suicidal story, it is your business. And so don't let the anger push you away. 805-781-3875 is the number to be part of our conversation today. I'm Elizabeth Barrett. My guest is Christine Claxton. And Bruce, thanks for calling. What's on your mind today?
Hi. Well, I do have a story that I think will be relevant to your listeners. So first of all, both of my two best friends lost their fathers to suicide. And at a certain point, I asked one of them to tell me the circumstance. And the circumstance was that the guy was very sick, was very depressed, and so forth and so on. And I happened to say, I kind of regret it, but I happened to say, well, given those circumstances, it could make sense. And the guy goes, yeah, it could make sense for the guy. As a matter of fact, the guy is in a better place. The problem is his wife and me and both of my sisters are in a much worse place, mm-hmm. Which, of course, it raises the question, given when if a person has loved ones, that the real issue at stake is the loved ones as opposed to the suicide victim himself, it seems to me. And it also raises the question, in the absence of loved ones, I hate to sound insensitive, but is there really a huge loss when somebody takes his own life and leaves literally no one to grieve in the circumstance of pain and horrible depression and so forth and so on? And before I close, can I have one more thing to say?
Absolutely, Bruce.
Okay. So this actually translated, fast forward 10 years, and it translated into my life where I was a very happy, productive, human being. I got diagnosed with prostate cancer. That was, a traumatic as one would expect. But the problem with this thing is that a lot of people are put on what's called androgen deprivation therapy, or a euphemism for chemical castration, mm-hmm. which chemically manufactures misery. It manufactures depression and the end of any functioning joy that you can possibly derive from your life. So when I went back from I was supposed to be on this for 2 years. I went back to the doctor after a year, and I said, look, I can't do this. And he goes, well, I'm trying to save your life. And I go, well, that's the problem right there, is that I'm actively trying to die. The only reason we're having this conversation and I didn't blow my brains out in the last 12 months is that I have kids. Mm-hmm. If I didn't have kids, we would not be having this conversation. So I guess my other point on this thing is you can – chemicals and circumstance can actively and fairly immediately change somebody from a very happy, productive, well-rewarded human being into somebody who passionately wants to die.
And how are you now, Bruce?
Well, I'm much better because the doctor said, okay, we're quitting this ADT, which, I mean, I was going to do anyway, and I still have undetectable PSA, so I'm fine. I'm still traumatized by this, but I'm certainly not suicidal.
I appreciate you taking the time to call because it is one of the things we grapple with. If someone gets to that point where they feel like there's no hope, they have no one they're leaving behind, do we have a moral, ethical right to step in and prevent them from committing suicide? And then as someone who does have loved ones, do we have a moral, ethical obligation to stay here for them?
Yes.
Things to consider. Yes. Thank you, Bruce. Thank you for calling.
That's a dilemma. I'm not really sure where that would go. If you don't have anyone to live for, that's already building in your hopelessness. Mm-hmm. So I guess life is precious. So we do need to do everything we can to support the people who are feeling that way.
Well, and we do go in and out of periods of mm-hmm. distress and despair and then can find that light of day again. I mean, we hear enough of those stories of people who felt that they were at the end, that were ready to give it all up and then had a moment of clarity and came back. So I think that it goes back to all of our lives are personal journeys.
Yes, definitely.
And that those who, when we love other people, part of the risk of love is that we can't control what those we love do or what they end up choosing to do. And so that risk of loving is that risk of hurting at some point as well.
It is. That's part of loving.
805-781-3875. Hi, Ann. You're on the air. What's on your mind?
So a friend of mine has a daughter. They live back east, and the daughter committed suicide. My girls are teenagers. They know their daughter. They're not, close friends because they live far away. They've met. They've played. They've stayed together. But I don't know how to tell my dark era teens, they've entered that the dark tunnel that is teenage girls, how she died. They do know that she died. I lied. I said she fell out of a tree, which is only half of the truth. I don't know how to tell them that without worrying about them with their own their dark stuff going on now, mm-hmm. that she actually committed suicide.
Right, that fear of triggering
exactly.
your own children. Yeah. What do you think, Christine?
I think that's going to be a really hard conversation, but I also think that we need to be honest with our children. And having to tell Zachary's brother and sisters what happened, it was hard. And it is very difficult. But I think they also deserve to know the truth because they need to know Zachary's story.
Right.
And so
in your case, they're family and they will see each other often. In our case, they live in Oklahoma. We live here. I've got one girl who's going to leave for college in a year. Chances of them ever seeing each other again are slim. So that's why... No other to just leave it lie or not.
Well, the thing, my concern is that suicide is part of our cultural truth. It is part of our cultural fabric. And your daughter that's getting ready to go to college is going to experience death and suicide and loss. And for me as a parent, I would rather have my children experience their first death or loss or suicide or trauma while they're at home so that I can help them through it.
Well, it's not their first death, suicide, or loss. Suicide, yes, but not loss. They've had death in their family. And I think it's just that this girl is the same age as my girls, going through similar things my girls are going through, and that's how she chose to deal with it. And these kids are like mirror images of each other, you know, and I could totally see my kids choosing that. Mm-hmm. And I feel like talking about it with them, I'm just afraid they'd be like, well, it worked for her.
I think it's worth having the discussion, though, because it goes back to the stigma of suicide, and we want to get rid of that stigma, that you do talk about it, so that, let's say they were triggered to have suicidal thoughts, that they know they can come to you or to maybe a friend of yours and say, gosh, I'm feeling suicidal, that word suicide can actually come out of their mouth and own it and have some background to it. It does. It stinks to have to tell somebody that their friend died by suicide. But I think it's more important to have the conversation and the truthful conversation.
Well, and we've had that part of the conversation. We just have left out this particular person. You know?
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, and again, for all of us as parents, we know our children and our family situation best, so it always depends on Absolutely. Our own individual situation. But from my professional perspective, I do think that not talking about things makes them more dangerous than having the conversation and opening the door. And I appreciate you calling in, because that also opens the door to the 13 Reasons Why television series that was released by Netflix last year. And there's been a lot of controversy around whether or not 13 Reasons Why was a good choice to allow out into the public domain. And Greg, I noticed that you wanted to say something about 13 Reasons Why.
Well, first I have to confess that I haven't seen the series, but what I did hear, I think it was in May, a school in Michigan, remarkably, had gathered 13 students up who each recorded their individual struggles and consideration of suicide, and they called 13 Reasons Why Not. And so every morning at the announcement period at school, one of the 13 kids would tell their story and give that one reason why they did not suicide. And I just think that it was just very heartwarming and very a real experience. And apparently that program was very successful, and the students every morning look forward to hearing the story of one person, one of their fellow students who dealt with the suicide possibility.
Thank you, Greg. And, you know, that's a good take on the 13 Reasons Why, because some of the controversy was around the fact that after the show aired, Google had a 20% increase in the first 19 days of searches regarding suicide and how to commit suicide. That represents 1.5 million more searches than usual in relation to suicide. Those who produced 13 Reasons Why argued that it opened the conversation, that anything that gets people talking about suicide and the challenges of being a teen and a young person is a good vehicle. But Dr. Dan Riedenberg, who's the executive director of the Suicide Awareness Voices for Education, said that, yes, it started conversations, but probably not the right conversations. And again, this conversation is almost too big for just 1 hour, but I want to make sure that we leave you with some tangible information. One, here are some signs of distress that if you're with someone and they are exhibiting any of these red flags, that you might want to step in and ask them, hey, how are you feeling? Are you considering suicide? Are you feeling suicidal? One, if they're talking about suicide or wanting to die, if you have evidence that the person has been gathering information about suicide, if they seem to have a hopelessness about them or have no reason to live, if they're talking about being a burden to others, if they've increased their use of alcohol or drugs, if they're acting anxious or agitated, they begin behaving recklessly, they are sleeping or eating too little or too much, they begin to withdraw or feel isolated, they begin to display extreme mood swings. What you can do is ask them, are you feeling suicidal? Do you have a plan? Have you made previous attempts? Do you really want to die? Make sure you, if they say yes, develop a safety plan with them. Get help. Don't leave them alone. Ask them if they have weapons or prescription drugs. And again, this might all feel terrifying to just flat out say to someone, but these might be the conversation starters or the questions that help someone begin to come out of the dark. They might be going down this path towards suicide, but the minute someone starts to call them out on it or recognize the behaviors, it might be the way to backpedal out. Ask them who their support system is and who you can call for them. And if there is no one, then put them in touch with Hotline or National Suicide Prevention Lifeline or the Santa Barbara Warm Line or the Monterey County or this new feature called Text to Talk. You can text 741-741 and say, I need help, or I'm considering killing myself, or I want to die, and they will get back to you immediately. Don't take it lightly, because suicide is a call for help in some direction, whether it's a permanent solution or an impermanent solution to a horrible situation. Christine Claxton, thank you so much for being a guest on my show. You can participate in the Out of the Darkness Walk in San Luis Obispo by registering at
afsp.org/SLO.
It's October 14th in Mission Plaza. It's a day of hope. It's a day of grieving. It's a day of joy. It's what life is about, feeling all of the feelings at once and being able to bring those feelings out into the dark and celebrate and connect with your community. I'm Elizabeth Barrett, and this has been a conversation with a reluctant therapist. You can listen to previous shows at kcbx.org. You can also reach me through elizabeth@thereluctanttherapist.com or listen to previous shows. You can podcast our shows through Apple Tunes. If you need more information, you can call the station or send me an email and I will get you the hotline numbers. As always, I appreciate you supporting Public Radio KCBX. I look forward to continuing our conversation next Tuesday at 2.
It was in another lifetime, one of toil and blood. The blackness was a virtue and the road was full of mud. I came in from the wilderness, a creature void of form. Come in, she said, I'll give you shelter from the storm. And if I pass this way again, you can rest assured I'll always do my best for her, on that I give my word. In a world of steel like death and men who are fighting to be warm, come in, she said, I'll give you shelter from the storm. Not a word was spoke between us, there was little risk involved, and everything up to that point had been left unresolved. Try imagining a place that's always safe and warm. Come in, she said, I'll give you shelter from the storm. I was burned out from exhaustion, buried in the hail, poisoned in the bushes and blown out on the trail. Haunted like a crocodile, ravaged in the corn. Come in, she said, I'll give you shelter from the storm. Suddenly I turned around, she was standing there, silver bracelets on her wrist, flowers in her hair. And she walked to me so gracefully and took my crown of thorns. Come in, she said, I'll give you shelter from a storm. Well, the deputy walks on hard nails and the preacher rides a mount. Nothing really matters much, it's doom alone that counts. And the one-eyed undertaker, he blows a funeral horn. Come in, she said, I'll give you shelter from a storm. Question, man, is it hopeless and forlorn? Come in, she said, I'll give you shelter from a storm. Well, I'm living in a foreign country, but I'm bound across the line. Beauty walks a razor's edge, someday I'll make it mine. If I could only turn back the clock to when God and her were born. Come in, she said, I'll give you shelter from the storm.